also the following the God of Kot and Elatoya. The incident involving Bathsheba was not an incident involving an ecstasy, she was involving a Grusha, albeit one who became a Grusha only retroactively, at least for some Rishonim. The Machlokes Tosfos and Rashi with regard to the get krisus of the Yitzchak Mechametz Beis David was an absolute divorce or a conditional divorce, a divorce conditioned upon non-return. That's the earliest attempt that we find to deal with the elimination of an aguna problem, or at least of one aguna problem, a very narrowly defined aguna problem. In point of fact, the Baal HaTurim on the Midbar Lamed Beis, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, tells us that the institution of a get krisus on behalf of a soldier about to go out in battle was not an innovation of David HaMelech, but was an institution promulgated by Moshe Rabbeinu. On the Pasuk Chalutzim Tavu Lifnei Acheichem, the word Chalutzim is usually translated as arm, correct? Says the Baal HaTurim that the term chalutz has the same, chalutzim, the singular chalutz, is identical with the phrase beis chalutz hana'al, and that the soldiers going into war were called chalutzim because it's a kind of almost a loshon sagilah. They had avoided the necessity for chalitza. The primary, or one of the primary motivations with regard to chalitza in those cases, with regard to resolving the so-called aguna problem in those cases, was to prevent a necessity for yivum or chalitza to free the widow to marry somebody else. Of course, there are really two problems. There's the problem that the soldier may not return and there may not be sufficient evidence to not give the wife to remarry. Or even if there is such evidence, if she has no children, she may be a shemeres yavam and there may be problems with regard to yibum and or chalitza. And later in the medieval period, we find the discussions of a get shidmera that was executed entirely to prevent the wife from being zekuka liyibum. The brother is not available, or the brother will not give chalitza for whatever reason. You have the person on his deathbed. There's no problem about his wife being permitted to remarry if there is proof of death. There is proof of death. We're here. We see he's dying. The problem is that she will not be able to remarry freely because she will be zekuka liyibum, and there is an attempt to prevent that by making her a grusha before she becomes an almona. As a grusha, there is no chiyuv yibum. So the Baal HaTurim says that the word chalutz in the Chumash refers to what the Gemara later ascribes to the period of Beis David, and says the Baal HaTurim that was noyig in Yemos Moshe Rabbeinu as well. Suffice it to say that the aguna problem that one finds in the biblical period, whether it's Moshe Rabbeinu or the time of David HaMelech, is in the situation of an individual goes off to war and there's a problem. Either there will not be or may not be evidence with regard to his death at war, or there will be a problem with regard to the yibum of his wife if he dies at war. The problem is the soldier problem. That's the oldest problem of yibum, the oldest problem of aguna, at least in terms of our historical references. By the time one reaches the Tkufa Hamishna, the problem seems to be an entirely different one. Here there's a problem of Nayim Sheyesh Lo Hemsoif, Nayim Shein Lo Hemsoif. You're dealing with Hilchei Drochim, Yerdei Hayom. Drochim are Becheska Sakone, and people go off on trips and don't come back. And the problem now is establishing proof of death so that the wife is eligible to remarry as a widow. By the time one reaches the Tzkufa of Rishenim, the problem is not so much, or at least there is another problem which is as severe as the problem of Yerdei Hayam and Hilchei Drochim, and that is the problem of a mumer. The problem, the husband is a mumer and doesn't want to execute the get, or more often, he has a brother who is a mumer, and she becomes a zekuka liyibum. There will be problems with regard to effecting a get, and the first instance of Kiddushin al-Tanai, which I have just been advised I shouldn't talk about today because you already have exhausted it in detail, is the Marie Brona, who talks about Kiddushin al-Tanai in order to prevent the woman from being a Zekuka Liyibum if the Ach is a Mumer. So you have Kiddushin al-Tanai if she becomes in the fellas of the evil, and the kedushin become bottle masoyan or amosite maribrona, and the problem then will be to distinguish it between other forms of kedushin al tanai if those other forms are not to be sanctioned. But that's a topic we won't go into today. In a later kufa, the problem of aguna is not really a problem of aguna at all, but I'll use the term as a homonym, one of the shemes hamishutofim, the modern day aguna involving the Baal HaMasarev Lagarish or the Baal Sarvan. That became a problem only in recent years, in relatively recent years, for a very simple reason, and that is that throughout the medieval period, Jews everywhere enjoyed judicial autonomy, at least with regard to family law matters. In many jurisdictions, with regard to other matters as well, including in some cases, jurisdiction in criminal cases, but it was virtually universal that they enjoyed autonomy in matters of family law and matters of gittin v'kiddushin. The result is that a man who wanted to remarry had no choice but to execute a get in favor of his wife. Otherwise, there was no possibility for remarriage. There is a cute little irony to all of this. This is, I don't want to go off into things that have nothing to do with halacha, but this is because of the particular status of Jews in medieval feudal Europe. They were servi chamberi, they were an imperium in imperio, servants of the chamber, the constable of the state within the state, even though they had no autonomy in terms of sovereignty over any given geographic area, but they were nevertheless recognized as a semi-autonomous individuals, much the way that America treats the Indians, although there, in a certain sense, it's associated with the geographic sovereignty. The Indians are a sovereign state, and you enter into treaties with them, even though they're all residing in the country. Jews had that kind of status, and it wasn't designed because of the chasodim of Uma Soilom. It was designed for other reasons. But it had a silver lining. The result is that in places such as the Tsarist Russia, divorce was not available to non-Jews because it was not recognized by the dominant religious authorities or by the authorities of the dominant religion. However, Jews were permitted to execute gittin because they had autonomy in such matters. It was arguably the case in Great Britain as well before 1865 or thereabouts when divorce was instituted in England. Jews nevertheless executed gittin and remarried. It was only in the 1920s that the question was asked whether they really had authority to do it retroactively, and it was presented in an entirely theoretical manner, but in practice, de facto, Jews had divorce in England just as they had in Russia, even though the Anglicans did not have divorce, other than by specific act of parliament. There was one exception in England. The problem of Baal HaMasarev Lagarish becomes a problem only with the French Revolution, the Enlightenment. Liberté, égalité, and fraternité is all very nice. And the rabbinic authorities, who were less than enthused by the slogan, were in part concerned about the disadvantages that would come in its wake. One of the disadvantages was that if you are citizens like everybody else, you have the same responsibilities, the same privileges, but no more. Therefore, you have lost autonomy in matters of personal family law, and you can now apply to civil courts for a divorce and get a civil marriage license and proceed to remarry. Since the walls of the ghetto have come tumbling down, it is also a lot easier to live outside the Jewish community so that you have the option of becoming an avarion and proceeding to be over on the Cheren Rabbeinu Gershon and now taking a second wife. And if you can cross this line, you'll be able to do so with impunity. Who cares if you will be subject to Cheren within the Jewish community if you no longer choose to associate with the Jewish community and this now becomes a viable option? The net result is that the modern-day Aguna, as I've called it, becomes a problem only after the French Revolution, and you find attempts to deal with this only after the French Revolution. And I'm going to concentrate today almost entirely on the problem of the so-called modern-day Aguna, or the Baal HaMasarev Lagarish, the Baal Sarvan, and the various remedies that have been proposed with regard to that particular problem. So far, I knew what I was going to say. from here on, I don't know what I'm going to say, for the very simple reason that in shiurim in another branch of this university a couple of years ago, I spent an entire year on the various proposals dealing with the Baal HaMasar of the Garish, and I don't quite know how to cover all of it in the time allotted, but I'll try. A number of solutions or resolutions of the problem had been formulated and floated. The earliest was a kind of Kiddushin al-Tanai, which I'm not going to talk about. That was the proposal of the French rabbinate, Zobuk Khan, the chief rabbi of France, came up with that bright idea and floated it for a while. And you have the response to that in the package that has been distributed, this little volume called, I think it's called Mitzuyin Al-Tanai, or Ein Tanai B'Mitzuyin, part of which has been Xeroxed for you, not in its entirety. You have the responses to the proposal of Sodor Khan, including a response of the Sofon, a response by the Or Sameach. There's even a little piece from Rav Chaim in this little package. There's one from Rav Chaim Ezer, and I'm not going to talk about it in any kind of detail. There has been, to the best of my knowledge and information, no substantive modification of the original proposal. The book by Berkowitz you are well familiar with. I must agree with the late Rav Kasher in saying that in going over it several times, I am in no way able to distinguish it from the proposal of the French rabbinate that was rejected by Gedolei Yisrael Bishapei, and I just don't see anything new to talk about. But we're not talking about Kiddushin al-Tanai. The second proposal, and I'm not necessarily presenting the proposals in chronological order. The second proposal was a shvuah on the part of the husband that under appropriate circumstances he would execute a get on behalf of his wife. There are two problems to that. The first problem is that unfortunately, by the Nesinu HaRabim, the individual who refuses to give the get is very likely to be a person to whom the chaymer of a shvuah is not going to be a deterrent. The Kol HaOlam was Nizdazeya at Har Sinai at Lesiso, but he isn't likely to tremble at the fear of having now been over on the shvuah. B. There's a problem in halacha, and that is a problem of Ein Tzeh V'Nafshei. A get is valid only if it is executed of the individual's free will without duress. However, there's a form of self-imposed duress. The person is forcing himself. And Machlech Zushenim, whether a get under those circumstances, is valid. The Ramo is Machriya Lachatila, not to execute such a get, but the effort the get is regarded as valid. It is for that reason that it is de rigueur at every Sidur HaGet to be makir any conceivable shvua that the Baal may have entered into with regard to the execution of the get, so that in case there is mention of the nashe, you're makir the get. You're makir the shvua. That's the purpose of it all. Yes. Well, the shvua would have been under the chuppah, or in the rabbi's office in the prenuptial interview, or wherever. Well, I'm not supposed to be talking about Kiddushin al-Tanai. I can't say it's the same problem or not the same problem, but the problem with Kiddushin al-Tanai is either that you'll be mevatel the Tanai, or that you'll make a second Kiddushin, which are unencumbered and unconditional. You cannot in any way modify the shvuah through an act of Kiddushin, be it. The problem is, yes, sure, there's always the possibility of the husband finding himself a Beis Din to be matir the shvuah, in which case the shvuah isn't going to help you anyway. That's the minor kind of a problem. The problem is, A, he won't bother about the shvuah, he won't be concerned about the shvuah. B, the shvuah itself creates a shaila. You now have a problem of Ein Tzeh V'Nafshei, and if he executes the get only pursuant to that shvuah, it's certainly something which we do not sanction the chatzilah. But I'm not worried about that. You can be matir the shvuah. Beis Din will be matir the shvuah for him before the Sidur HaGet. The real concern is it's not going to help you when you're dealing with an avarian. An avarian isn't concerned about the shvuah. It's as simple as all that. It's not really an expedient. The other proposal was, and it appears in various guises, the other proposal is an undertaking of one kind or another to appear before a Beis Din for the purposes of enforcing, of executing a get. And to give it teeth, it has to provide for some kind of financial penalty for non-performance. The earliest version of this, or at least the earliest formal version of this, is the so-called Lieberman Clause in the Conservative Tzuva that was promulgated by the so-called Rabbinical Assembly of America in the 1950s. I didn't give you the Lieberman Clause in the package for reasons that I don't think I have to explain, but let me read it to you. It reads as follows. Utsviyu mar blank chasandanan, umoras blank, sultado. Lemishbak dein lado vadol ledein, lemino koyime chayevin, beorcho de iraiso. Kehilk is gubrin yuhudoyin. The Aramaic is first century Yerushalmi Aramaic. It's perfect. They undertake that each will conduct his life beorcho de iraiso, that's an Anglicism, in the paths of Torah. That's the Aramaic of Rabbinical Assembly. Is Aramaic for Atzus Abris. They will be bound by the Bezdin or those who are their bo'etoyach, their delegated agents. They are the only ones who have jurisdiction. Rishu here is authority, not permission. To teach them. During the course of their marital life, these are the only people who can provide them with spiritual direction for this purpose. The kabil nafshehim kol chad minen la'arushol l'chaver l'zamlu yosei l'veidino d'id karmineilo. Each one has granted the other authority to summon to appear before the aforementioned bezdin. Yisrnei tigro v'neihoin. If there will be some quarrel between them. B'dil v'yeku l'meche kol chad yirei minhoin b'dini reitzo kol yimechayi. So each one of them can follow the ways of a reitzo, the ways of prayer, all the days of the light. And the aforementioned Bezdin is given authority. Pitsuyin is this magic phrase that both Edin in modern times use for a financial award, and one is never certain whether it is compensation, whether it's a knas, whether it's a pshoret, falls under this general category of pitsuyin. Kol kat minahein ilo itzvi lemezel kodemoi bedino. If they refuse to appear before them, Ludin, or if they will refuse to abide by the judgment of the court. Now, this was designed to compel people to appear before this particular rabbinic body and to execute a get pursuant to its direction. Let me analyze it from various standpoints. My first problem with regard to that language is that, and I'm sorry to make an argument that nobody else has made, but I have no other way of dealing with it. If this were presented to a court of law, and the court of law had to deal with this as you deal with every contract, the first thing the court has to ask is, what does it say? It says that you appear before the Bezdin for purposes of receiving instruction with regard to how to conduct yourselves the orche the iraiso. It sounds as if you're submitting to the jurisdiction of this tribunal, who's going to function as a kind of a marriage counselor. They're going to teach you how to live a nice Jewish life within the marital framework. There is no mention of a get whatsoever. It sounds like a submission to marital counseling. At most, you can stretch that to say that if the Orche de Uraiso command a get, there's grounds for Kfiya Ligaresh, the Bezdin then has the authority to command the parties to execute a get. So far, so good. What about a case where there are no grounds for Kfi and Halacha? If there are no grounds for Kfi and Halacha, I fail to see how any fair reading of this document would enable any Bezdin to order the parties to execute a get. And remember that the part Bezdin can order a party to execute a get even without this document. Questions whether or not it's enforceable in civil law in the absence of this document is a separate question. Following Stern versus Stern in the state of New York, the court has ruled that every ksuba is at least an implied contract to dissolve the marriage in accordance with Jewish law, and the court found all kinds of grounds for dissolving a marriage in Jewish law that I'm not aware of, or at least I'm not sure of. The court decided that even the allegation of adultery is sufficient to compel the husband to execute a get in halacha, something which I won't talk about today, but I'm far from certain that's true. Whether adultery or not is grounds for compelling a get in halachas for shame. An allegation of adultery, even coming with an amasla afterwards, I'm certain is not. But the court seemed to find that. So that in terms of the law of the state of New York, I don't know what this document serves, what purpose the document serves anymore. But you know, granted that the document is there, it makes explicit what might already be implied in the standard ksuba, and under those circumstances, fine. If it's necessary to make it explicit, there certainly is no objection to making that explicit. As I read the text, it confers no authority upon the Beis Din, which from the vantage point of halacha, it does not already have. Now, to be sure, the authors and promulgators of that document assumed that pursuant to its clauses, the Beis Din would be able to command a get under any and all circumstances when they thought it advisable to do so. As a matter of law and as a matter of halacha, I don't see it in the contract. Now, yes?
Are we really looking for a way to
precisely. That's point number two. The problem with kfiya when halacha does not provide for kfiya. Kfiya where halacha does not provide for kfiya results in a get musa. If this were to be used by anybody, two words, anybody, regardless of its composition, to coerce a get where halacha does not provide for coercion of a get, it would be a get musa. And would be invalid. That was the first objection raised against this document. The document provides for a form of kfiya through the imposition of pitsuyin, which is just another word for knas in this circumstance. It is a penalty. The penalty presents the problem of asmachta. Most penalties cannot be enforced in Bote Din because they simply are not binding undertakings. They cannot be enforced in civil law either for other reasons. It's very problematic with regard to whether or not the pitsuyim provided in this document could be enforced in a secular court because the court would construe that as a penalty and penalties are not enforceable. The problems in halacha are that if it is an asmachta, then asmachta is not enforceable. Any attempt to enforce it is kfiya shalei kedin and is in and of itself would render the get invalid. The second problem is that even if there are grounds for kfiya, it's only pursuant to asei mash yisrael emrim l'cho that requires the Beis Din of ksherim. The Beis Din referred to in this document is not a Beis Din of ksherim, but that could be easily changed by, instead of saying the Beis Din of the Beis Midrash of Rabbonon, by saying the Beis Din of somebody or some organization who has a Beis Din of ksherim. It will be easily enough remedy rectified. But the real problem, or the nub of the problem, is that we are dealing with an asmachta, and asmachta is not enforceable, and even if it is enforceable, if you would overcome the problem of asmachta, we would be back to the machlekes rishonim with regard to Einsod Dinafshei. This is another case of Einsod Dinafshei. A person is executing the get because he is afraid that if he doesn't do so, he will be penalized by imposition of this knas. He has assumed the knas voluntarily, and we will assume it's enforceable for purposes of this argument. It then constitutes an ein tzad nafshei, which l'chatchila one does not execute a get, so the effort to get may be valid. But any form of knas seems to involve this problem of an einso dinashe. Any knas that is enforceable, even if it's enforceable, will present the problem of einso dinashe. And I'm only sketching with broad outlines the problems associated with either this penalty clause or any other penalty clause that can be devised. Yes.
But if we pass in this going to the mother, did he have in this kosher, it's definitely better than a guna.
Sure. It may be the Mokum Igum, something to be seen upon. However, that certainly should not mean that we have found the panacea, that we have found an optimum solution to the problem. I will, in the course of the time in draining, try to argue that there are optimal solutions, there are better things than this out there. Yes?
Although in the absence of any other accepted solution, if this solution were accepted, it would be better than nothing.
That was the point the previous speaker made. I agree that it would at least deserve and merit serious consideration. My problem is that it is not enforceable in a court of law in the state of New York. Now, I suppose I should say a word or two about the veto. The people who wrote this were very careful to keep it out of the courts, and it succeeded for over 25 years, until finally in a veto it got to the courts. The decision in Avitur is very problematic. Nobody really knows what the court decided in Avitur. Avitur was a husband and wife, signed one of these things, and then they separated, they had a civil divorce, and the wife wants the husband to go to the divorce assembly for purposes of executing the debt. The court in Avitur, at least the lower courts, treated it as an agreement to sign a gift, which it wasn't. I don't read it that way, and I think it's a misreading of the document, and the court treated it incorrectly. On appeal, the Court of Appeals, there are a number of problems here. The problem is A, the problem of a penalty clause which is not enforceable, B, the problem of First Amendment rights, free exercise. Now, to the everlasting credit of Boaz Avitur, Mr. Avitur never claimed that his First Amendment free exercise rights were being jeopardized by being compelled to go to a Beis Din. However, the establishment argument didn't have to be raised by one of the litigants that the court has to raise on its own, and the court never really dealt with that. In effect, what the court said was to go back to the Beis Din, let the Beis Din, the court, the Beis Din says go back, find out what this all means, the court says go back to the Beis Din, find out what this all means, and we'll deal with it some other time. It is clear that the Court of Appeals of the State of New York said that you have to go to the Beis Din. It is not clear that the court was willing to confirm a judgment of the Beis Din to execute a get. Then you'll ask, what's the point of sending them to the Beis Din if they're not going to enforce the decision of the Beis Din? There's precedent for that in New York law. A submission to non-binding arbitration has been upheld by the courts in the state of New York. The idea being, sure, if you don't like what the arbitrator says, you're not supposed to listen, but at least go and let him say what he has to say. Maybe he'll convince you to agree. It is very possible that the court treated this as a kind of agreement to submit to marriage counseling, religious marriage counseling. Go to the counselors. Let them tell you whatever they have to tell you. They may resolve the dispute. If they don't resolve the dispute and you come back, we may find ourselves without a remedy. We may not be able to enforce the decision of the Beis Din, but at least we will view this as an agreement to appear before rabbinic arbitrators for some purpose or other, and at least to that extent we will enforce this as a kind of submission to arbitration. That's frankly how I would read the decision. Now, of course, in another forum I will argue that Avitur was a decision of the Court of Appeals saying that there's no entanglement, there's no First Amendment problem, you signed an agreement to go to arbitration, we will simply rubber stamp the decision of the arbitrators, and that does not involve First Amendment problems, there's no entanglement, blah, blah, blah. Who knows? It was a 4-3 decision, and nobody knows what would ever happen if this gets back. As far as the Knaf is concerned, I doubt that that part is enforceable. I doubt very much that any court would enforce the penalty clause, which means, in a certain sense, maybe even better, you can get specific performance. You can force the people to go before the Beis Din. Who cares about the Knaf if you can get them to appear? If the court will then will then order the husband to execute a get pursuant to the decree of the Beis Din, fine. We're home safe. However, if it turns out that the court will not command the execution of the get, you haven't accomplished very much at all. More significantly, you have accomplished absolutely nothing unless the Beis Din is prepared to find grounds for kfiyah. And anyone familiar with the Pesach Din Rabbonim, which is both the Din Eretz Yisrael, who do have police power to enforce their decisions, are extremely reluctant to issue a Pesach Din of kfiyah for what may be very good grounds. Those decisions and those Pesach Din are few and far between, and whether that's correct and appropriate is a topic for some other time, certainly not for this hour. But the net result is that this the Lieberman's laws, or anything in its guise, any one of the descendants of the Lieberman clause, is not likely to solve the problem. Therefore, one doesn't have to reach the question of Ensur Nashe and determine whether half a loaf or a b'dieved b'mokonigun is better than nothing. However, even at this point, I'll make one comment. In the packaging materials that has been given to you, there is a document which is accompanied with an article, and it, I think it says a post-avisur proposal. What I have done there is to prepare a document which is certainly enforceable in the state of New York. It will enforce only what the document says it can enforce, and that is, it will command appearance before a Bezdin. It will not give the Bezdin authority to pass mitzvah when there is no grounds for tefillah, and all that, it doesn't guarantee that the court will enforce, no, that's another one. It is no guarantee that the court will enforce a psak din to execute the get, even when there's a psak din of tefillah, but it does force the people into the Bezdin, and that will resolve a great many, if not the majority, of all of these problems. At least in the state of New York, there is virtual certainty that the courts will command the parties to appear before the Bezdin. They can then draw them. That's very significant. And, you know, in the real world out there, in the real world, the problem is getting them to Bezdin. When you get them to Bezdin, then there are all kinds of things that you can do. There is such a thing as the powers of moral persuasion. But you can exercise those only on people who are listening. If there's nobody listening out there, then you don't have a prayer. You've got to have somebody to talk to. This gives you someone to talk to. It has the added advantage. There's another problem that is remedied by the Lieberman Clause, and that is in Powell versus Powell. The court, it was lower court, not a court of appeals, but it was pursuant to an agreement by the parties to execute a get. The parties then refused, one of the parties then refused to cooperate, and the court stepped in and appointed the Bezdin. On appeal, the Supreme Court said that whatever this document means and whatever its enforceability is in terms of New York law, in terms of constitutional law, one thing courts cannot do, and that is courts cannot appoint an ecclesiastic court. So I have the dubious distinction of being the only rabbi declared unconstitutional by the state of New York. That got thrown out. Now, the Lieberman Clause specifies a body, and there's always the problem. You go in on a stern type of argument that the courts will say, fine, but we can't tell you who to go to. And there are lots of Bokidin out there and lots of rabbis. The advantage of this post-Avitzer agreement is that you're forced to spell out either the names of the Dayanim or the organization whose Bezdin shall have authority, and there should be no problem in New York at least in getting people to appear before Bezdin if you use a post-Avitzer kind of agreement. Now remember, as far as Halach is concerned, that agreement poses no problem whatsoever, because all it binds the parties to do is what they're mechuyev to do anyway. When it's a dishtuk, go to Bezdin issues out money. You gotta go. The wife wants a get. Who thinks she's entitled to a get? But she's entitled to a hearing in front of a Bezdin. She is summoning the husband to go to the Bezdin, not to execute the get, but to hear her petition for coercion of a get, or for advice to the husband to execute a get, or whatever it is that the Bezdin may find is an appropriate remedy in the circumstances. There's no problem with halacha with that kind of agreement, and it's certainly enforceable in New York.
Why in the real world would not giving a get without compulsion in the circumstances seem to say that the reality of some reason based on worthless upon what would that be?
Because when a man tells his lawyer in the sanctity of the lawyer's office, he doesn't have the gall to say in the Bezdin. He can tell his lawyer, tell her that I'll give her a get if she gives me $100,000. He's less likely to say that in the Bezdin. Particularly after the most recent case in which there now may be grounds for recovering that money. If you make such a statement publicly, you've now created all kinds of legal problems for yourself. In addition to all of that, the Bezdin, you know, his lawyer is working for him. The lawyer says, $100,000? Fine. I'm going to get a cut, or at least I'm going to get a fee for getting you $100,000. When he says it to the Bezdin cries, shake it. Now, the Bezdin says, it's not right. I'm not supposed to be doing things like that. The Bezdin will do whatever else the Bezdin can do. There are all kinds of ways that you can involve other people to apply pressure on this person, short of field.
The hardcore people who are
It will not help the hardcore people. It doesn't help the hardcore people. I certainly do not hold out the post Avitzur form that's been prepared as the ultimate solution. It is not. I think there are better solutions. That's the half a loaf, or a quarter of a loaf, or three quarters of a loaf. I don't know. It'll help in some cases. It won't help in all cases, and it is certainly not the optimum solution. Before going on to some of the other agreements that can be formulated, let me backtrack just for a minute or two and talk about one of the proposals that had been suggested back in the 30s. And that is that at the time, not Kiddushin al Tanai, but that at the time of the marriage, the husband appoint a sefer and edim to execute a get whenever they find it proper to do so. One gentleman went so far as to suggest that a document be prepared in which the husband would be memane the bride to serve as tishliach to execute a get and to deliver it to herself. Now, all the objections that apply to Kiddushin al Tanai apply to that, plus the general problem of Breirah. You're now making this contingent upon what is virtually the arbitrary will or whim, and even if you predicate it upon the execution of a civil decree by some secular court, then you're making it contingent upon the das or the rots and the secular judges, and you've also got greater problems. I don't want to analyze that in detail. Obviously, it doesn't work for a lot of reasons. Let me then go back to some of the proposals that have been floating around and ways in which prenuptial agreements can be harnessed to achieve the desired effect. In this package, you will find another article that appeared in the Jewish Law Annual, in which there is a proposal for an antenuptial agreement that is designed, its real purpose is designed to enable a woman to get a get whenever she wants it. But that's not what it says. It is a proposal for what I call tesis mizonos, or to be dramatic, tosefet mizonot. The problem is to fashion a contract that provides for a penalty which isn't a penalty. Any provision that will provide for a transfer of money for failure to execute a get is a penalty, and a penalty by any name is a penalty. What one is trying to do is to create a certain set of circumstances in which it is to the husband's financial advantage to divorce his wife. But heaven forfend that you impose a penalty for failing to divorce. There is one form of tzvia which is absolutely legitimate. Why does any husband divorce his wife? Remember that biblically, polygamy is absolutely permissible. The major motive underlying most contemporary divorces is absent in halacha, or at least halacha before Rabbeinu Gershon. Most people want a divorce so they can go out there and marry somebody else. But a husband doesn't divorce his wife because he wants to marry somebody else. He can marry somebody else anyway. He divorces his wife because he wants to become pater from Sher Ksuz Vaino. He wants to relieve himself of obligation toward this woman. That is not tzvia, by definition. The desire to avoid obligations imposed by virtue of the marital state by halacha is not tzvia. Any obligations that flow from the marriage, which I seek to avoid by a get, isn't tzvia. That's what a get is all about. A get is designed to terminate those obligations. The husband who is a pauper and divorces his wife because he cannot afford mizonos is not acting out of tzvia. He is divorcing her because he doesn't want the person to take his last cent away from him to support his wife. That's not tzvia. The obligations of mizonos incumbent upon a husband are carefully spelled out in halacha. What they are, we don't have to go into. It depends upon his economic status, the social status of his wife before the marriage, etc., etc. There is nothing that I am aware of that prevents a husband from assuming a level of support and maintenance far in excess of the standard imposed by halacha. In fact, I have a precedent. The precedent is a Rashi and Chumash. In the story of Esav and Yankov, Yitzchok wants Esav to bring him matanim, And instead, Rivka provides a goat for Yankov to bring to the Yitzchak. Rashi, in effect, is asking a kasha. Who gives her the right to do it? Yitzchak is saying, he's not giving him rishus to take any of the animals in his flock. He wants Krayi, which is in a hefke. And here is Rivka, who is going and taking one of Yitzchak's own animals and slaughtering it. Who gives her the right to do it? What's Rashi's answer? He gives her an allotment of two gedim every day. I submit that no person can consume two goats in a single day. Clearly, he gave her two goats a day so that she could sell the goats and buy herself a mean coat. Or whatever else it is that she wants to do with the proceeds of the sale of two goats. This is Tosfos and Zainus. It is a level of support and maintenance far in above that which is provided by virtue of the obligations of a husband vis-a-vis his wife. There's no reason in the world why a person can't enter into such an obligation. Therefore, I see no impediment in halacha that would provide for a contractual agreement of Tosfos and Zainus in which the husband agrees to pay the wife a certain stipulated sum of money per day. You name the sum, $200 a day, $500 a day, $1,000 a day, whatever it is, as long as it is a clearly stipulated sum. At this point, any woman who wants a divorce simply has to go to her husband and say, please fork over the money. It will clearly state in this contract that this is an obligation which is binding so long as there is a marriage which is valid in Jewish law. Now, there are certain problems. The first problem is that even if the husband wants to execute a get, the meter is running. He's obligated to $200 a day, $500 a day, whatever it is, he won't.
Wait a minute.
The simple formulation would have it running from the day of the marriage, which means that it runs and runs and runs, and no husband will sign this because if he's willing to give a get, she will, you know, get more than the most extravagant alimony award. Okay. The first thing I would argue is that halacha says that a woman cannot collect mezainis retroactively. There is a presumption that the woman doesn't claim mezainis, she's in meichel, she can only claim the kind of l'abro. I would argue that tesis mezainis is governed by the same provision. If she hasn't claimed, she won't collect. If I'm wrong, then all you have to do is spell it out. You put in the document, it says explicitly that she collects the tesis mezainis only when she makes application to the Beis Din, and there is contractual forgiveness for any day she doesn't appear before the Beis Din. Now, obviously, so long as there's Sholem Bayis, no woman is going to claim this. When there is no Sholem Bayis, she is going to begin claiming this. At that point, she gets the divorce on demand. There are a certain other problems that might arise, or certain other considerations that might make us hesitate to use this, and that is that what if the husband is perfectly willing to divorce the wife, but she doesn't want to accept the get? Under those circumstances, the husband doesn't want to be bound to pay tesis mezainis, even if the Beis Din is not going to issue a psak din of tzvi as far as the wife is concerned, to be kreif for her to accept the get. And after Chayim Rabbein Gershon, they're not likely to issue such a psak din. So you put in a little clause saying that so long as there is a valid marriage in halacha, and it continues to exist only because the husband has not sought to terminate it. Language which will clearly state that if the husband seeks to terminate the marriage by executing get, by being memanah shliach, to deliver the get whenever the wife is willing to accept it, he will no longer be bound by any of this. The simple way of doing this is and to make sure that it has nothing to do with the divorce, is by putting in a clause that says that the wife is entitled at her option on any day to one of the following. Either mezainis al shulchanai or a stated dollar allotment per day. So that any day, if the wife goes to the refrigerator and takes some orange juice and Rice Krispies, she has forfeited her right to collect this cash allowance for the day. But whenever she wants a separate vacation, she can demand this as an allowance. That's nothing to do with a get. If she wants to go off for a couple of days and wants to use this as her allowance for the vacation, she will be able to claim it in Beis Din and there will be no problem. This is not a penalty for not executing a get. It is the level of mezuinis for which the wife has contracted at her option during the lifetime of the marriage. I think that A, it's immune to all of the challenges of halacha with regard to penalty clauses, asnachta, ainsa de nafshe, etc. And I think it would even hold up in court. Yes?
On a legal level,
the answer, because they asked the question number one, yes, it will not work against an impoverished person. No knas will work against an impoverished person. So you know, the whole knas avenue doesn't work against the pauper. B, will this survive bankruptcy? I would argue that it does survive bankruptcy because it's an ongoing obligation. It arises anew every day. You can't discharge that in bankruptcy. And if it doesn't survive bankruptcy, what can I do about it? Okay? I mean, again, an ultimate tendency I don't have, but it seems to me that this survives bankruptcy the same way the ordinary support and maintenance would survive bankruptcy. And you've got, in effect, a new obligation just triggered each day. So that although everything from before has been discharged in bankruptcy proceedings, the meter starts ticking all over again the next day. Now, let me then go to one of the penalty clauses, which is much more complicated, but it's much more straightforward. I frankly don't know what it has as an advantage over what I have just spelled out. I have heard Me'achari HaParagud that there are some people who argue that if there's an umdene, that all of this is only for purposes of marriage, so that in effect we've got the problem of Ainsa de Nafshe, and that in effect it's a knas all over again. I don't see it as an umdene. The people I've discussed this with don't see it as an umdene. But if anybody thinks it's an umdene, I have one simple cure for that. And that is to ask some cooperating husband and wife to enter a test case before some recognized person. And you can engineer this. You can have a wife who decides that she wants to go, wants to go to the Catskills for 2 weeks during the summer, and we have her husband pro forma refuse to pay the bill, let her go to Beis Din and ask the Beis Din for a psak din on the contract whether or not she is entitled to this. Now, it's very easy if you have a husband and wife who have a perfectly fine relationship, and every summer she goes off to a hotel, he joins her only on weekends, he's been paying the bill for years. That this applies only in cases of divorce, and the day afterwards, nobody could possibly argue that there's a movement that only in cases of divorce and only in the form of a smash. Now, the other thing that has been kicking around for a number of years and finally was published both in tradition about 2 years ago, or probably, yeah, 2 years ago and earlier, in the Sefer HaYezel published by Mr. Rav Kook in honor of Rav Soloveitchik, and this is the utilization of the Eitz of the Chachmei Sforad. Now, for reasons that we don't have time to go into, there are many Rishonim who maintain that while Asmachta applies to an undertaking which is conditioned upon something or other, it does not apply to a Mechila. Mechila in the form of a smachta is actionable. Therefore, and the problem of knas is a recurrent one in halacha. The most obvious case that you're familiar with, if you ever heard tznoyim, ordinary articles of engagement, involve the assumption of a penalty. And the problem, going back to the Balei HaTosfos, is how do you enforce it? It's a knas. By breaking shidduch, I pay a certain amount of money. Tosfos explains how it is you can enforce it. I'm interested in basic affairs. The Rambam quotes the Chachmei Sforad as saying that this is what the Chachmei Sforad did whenever they wanted a knas, which is unenforceable. When they want the knas that's unenforceable, they had the person whom they wanted to assume the penalty to assume an unilateral obligation. And then the other person to whom who is beneficiary of this obligation is Neufel al-Knai. Okay, you've had a simple example. If I'm a builder, contractor. I put up houses. and somebody wants to buy me to put up a house by September 1st. If I don't put up by September 1st, they want a penalty of $50,000. That's not enforceable in the court of law. It's not enforceable in halacha, that's not that. I don't do these things unless I intend to perform. Therefore, there's no gemara das. However, there's a simple way of doing it for the chasam svarai. I'm the builder. I enter into a building contract. You pay me whatever you pay me for the house, and I execute a new document. I unilaterally agree to pay you $50,000. And that's the chayvus bishtar. I owe you $50,000. That has nothing to do with our building. You then execute a nechilus, saying that if you put up a house by a certain day, at that time, you will forgive this chayv of $50,000. And that is what some people tried to harness for purposes of establishing a knas, which isn't a knas. You have then the following situation. The husband undertakes a unilateral obligation in favor of the wife, a false in favor of the chala, for $100,000, $1 million, you name it. The wife agrees to forgive it if he executes a get in her favor. She can demand payment whenever she wants to, or at least in the, my formulation. She can demand payment whenever she wants. Other people would put in conditions. You can demand payment only under certain conditions. And then you have a mechila al tanai. There is a mechila of this obligation if you have executed a get. Now, incidentally, one point I should have made earlier, and that is that my proposal of Tesis Mizenus is nothing new by any means. So at least I will argue it's not new because the Chodesh is also not there. And certainly doesn't have to be incorporated in the Ksuba to offend those who think that the text of the Ksuba is a halacha Moshe Sinai. I searched the Nachos Shiva and Baruch Hashem, I discovered something called Tznoyim Achreinim. The Tznoyim that we are familiar with are called Tznoyim Rishonim. There was another institution known as Tznoyim Achreinim. The Tznoyim Achreinim essentially provided nothing more than an acknowledgement that everything had been done that was supposed to have been done. It also, in the text found in Nachos Shiva, provided for the following circumstance. If Chas V'Sholem, Yek Tov V'Benehem, such that the woman can no longer remain under the same roof with the husband, then the husband is mechayev himself, kach v'kach, zehubim l'chedesh, ad shiyamdu l'din v'apien ko yek horiv omega. The husband obligates himself to pay X number of gold coins per week when the wife has left him until such time as they appear before the Beis Din. Now what kind of an obligation is this? This is Nachmachta. Who says she's going to leave? Who says he's going to gain from his life? She's a Meredith role before we know. How can he be obligated to pay this stipulated amount? So the footnotes in the Nachmachta Shiva say that this was Takon Ashum. So Takon Sakilis. We can't make a Takon, so I can't use that. But this Tesis Mizenus is presented in the form of Tnoim Achreini. And instead of the stipulated sum, which is a knas, or an asmachta, we have a voluntary undertaking. So in effect, this is not new. This is simply being matzvah torah. We have, tongue-in-cheek, this mini kodesh, the kodum of tnoim achreinim, and we now want to revive it, and the provisions aren't terribly much different from the provisions of the original tnoim achreinim. Now, the proposal that was originally propounded by Dick involved a situation in which you would have these two documents, and in fact you'd have four documents because you want to somehow to assure that the wife will accept the get under the appropriate circumstances, and he then proceeded to merge all of them into a single document. You've got these obligations back and forth with Mechila back and forth. Net result is that if any one of the parties wants a get and you don't execute the get, you may find that you have to deliver $100,000 to the other party. The major objection to that is the Tayyar's Gittin, the Beis Yankiv and Subas. You have that page here someplace in the package. The objection voiced by the Beis Yankiv is that in all of such cases, there can be a chazora so long as the parties are still seated. Somebody have it? Page 84. I don't have numbers. Second sheet from the end of. No, I give you the text for the shankar. That is my other. Yes, I have the second sheet. Okay. It's before the base of the. Okay. What the Bishanki was saying, he was dealing with something very similar. And he wanted a unilateral undertaking and a conditional mechila. His argument is that if you will not get the conditional mechila at the same sitting as they were dealing with the kinyan suder, the person who has bound himself by kinyan suder can be chazer from the kinyan suder, which in effect means that this is being predicated upon the mechila, which turns it into a knas. You're now dealing with a situation in which it's in contemplation of the get, because it's done only if you will not be measuring in terms of the get, and you have an effect what is turned right back into a kind of snap. His argument is that while it appears to be unilateral, it's not unilateral, so that if you can be phaser until such time, we know very well he will be phaser if he's not measuring. Therefore, you, to all intents and purposes, are back to square one. You do not have the eighth of the Chafna Sora. Now, this was the objection that we raised against Dick, and what is in this last article and tradition really involves no chidush whatsoever. The solution, I think, is a very simple one, and that is the Chazorah can be only when there are sukim b'yisi inyan, arranged to have the obligation on the part of the husband done before the wedding, and then arranged for the mechila right before the chuppah. Of course, if there's no mechila, there will be no chuppah, but that has nothing to do with the original undertaking on the part of the husband. The original undertaking of the part of the husband could certainly be predicated upon the marriage. That wouldn't be a problem, but it would not be predicated upon the mechila of the wife. And since it's not predicated upon the mechila of the wife, we would not have the problems that arise in terms of the objections raised by the Bishanki. This would be an eitze harnessing the device of the Chachmei Svarad, as they proposed it to overcome the chesaron of Asmachta, and would then make it possible to devise a form of knas. That's the Dick proposal, or at least a modification of the Dick proposal. It's rather cumbersome. It suffers from a number of disadvantages. The disadvantages are that it's not easy to draft this kind of document, but it can be done. The drafting isn't the problem. The problem is the explanation. It's a complicated business to explain to Fos and Kala, for them to understand what it is that you have drafted in this highly complicated way. Moreover, it does involve a specific reference to the contemplated breakdown of the marriage. And whatever psychological trauma is associated with that still remains. The device involving Tisefis Mizenis has as a considered advantage, A, that it's really very simple. B, you don't have to talk about divorce at all. It has nothing to do with divorce. You can, with a straight face, talk about the wife's right to claim enhanced level of support and maintenance at her option, with the clear understanding that she's going to do all of these things only when there is an anticipation that it's by the mutual consent of the parties, and that the husband's able to afford it, etc., etc., and the full recognition that under other circumstances she's going to try to claim all of this only when she is really not interested in continuing the marital relationship. And, you know, that overcomes a lot of the other problems. A simple form of knas, such as has been floating around in a rather non-formal manner, I fail to see how it avoids the problems of asmachta, or how it avoids the problems of get muse, or how it can be made enforceable in a civil court, although the attempt has been to dress it up as a kind of damage clause, liquidated damages, as it's called in legalese, as compensation to the wife for not enabling her to remarry freely. Now, insofar, any questions, first of all, with regard to any of this? Yes. The Beishankas problem was that the Eitz of the Chachmei Svarad doesn't work when you are dealing with a situation such as we're outlining, because the person who is entering into the undertaking can be Chazer and called Mother of Tzitzin Beishin Inyan. As long as they're still talking about the contract, as long as they haven't gotten up and left. They're seated around the table, here is a contract, and here comes the Mechila. Everybody knows that if the Mechila isn't forthcoming, the husband is going to tear up the contract that he signed. He still has the right to do so, even though he has entered into the agreement via Kinyan Suber, but whenever you're dealing with the Kinyan Suber, he can be Chazer from the Kinyan as long as they are seeking those the union. Therefore, everybody knows, that the undertaking was predicated upon the Mechila. Hence, you're back not to a universal, not to a unilateral, unequivocal undertaking, but you have a conditional undertaking, which is back to a machnachta. You're back to the old problem of a machnachta, is what the Tzuris Gittin, in effect, is arguing. Because all these things are being done at one sitting. And clearly, if they're done in one document, in one writing, once it's a paper, the argument of the Beishankas certainly applies. The modification or this change that I would suggest in the original proposal makes it much more cumbersome because you have more pieces of paper floating around and you're going to have to execute them at different times. It's a rather unwieldy kind of thing, but it is by no means an impossible kind of thing. It can be done. That may be a sukkim based union. However, if you do it at different times, it's no longer a sukkim based union. In terms of filter sleeping, you couldn't be phaser anymore. He couldn't be phaser anymore. If he was executed in the pre-nuptial interview, he can no longer be phaser even if the Mechila is not forthcoming. Of course, he has the right not to get married. But that's an entirely different matter. That right he preserves, and that right doesn't affect the undertaking. All right? Any questions, problems with any of this? I'm sorry? It seems to me that you can make the obligation be chal one day after the marriage, or even make it conditional upon marriage. In which case, even though he's entered into a unilateral obligation, it's a unilateral obligation subject to marriage, and that's not a smachta. It's only involving the person in some kind of penalty for non-performance that you have problems with a smachta. In making conditions upon the marriage, you're not involved in a problem of a smachta. Let me then go back to some of the other points that I had raised earlier with regard to various proposals that had been made in terms of overcoming this problem. The problem of being memane, a shliach, to execute the get under certain circumstances is one that arises in an entirely different situation, and that is in the case of Gitei Milchoma. The old-time Gitei Milchoma were rather simple and straightforward, and that's because war, once upon a time, was simple and straightforward. Wars didn't last very long. You went out to battle, and hopefully you came back, and if heaven forfend, you didn't come back, And you now have the get in place that will terminate the marital relationship, either retroactively or in lieu of proof of death in battle, you would not be able to establish the fact that people have been divorced on the basis of this get. The real problems occur when you have modern warfare that continues for an extended period of time, and then you have the notion of a furlough. the notion that people come home during war for a stipulated period of time and then return. The problem is that on a furlough, there may be a bitul of the get, a bitul of shlichus. There's a presumption that the parties cohabit. They have negated either the shlichus for the get or the get itself if the get has been prepared for delivery. And you find, and this is discussed in the, some of it may be in the article in Gidei Milchomer that comes from Teresh Baal Peh. You find as recently as World War II, there were some Gedolei Yisrael who maintained that you had to execute a new harshoah, or a new shlichus, or a new get every time you came home on furlough. The chief exponent of the position that this would not have to be done was Rav Avramsky. Rav Avramsky, who was then in England, was of the opinion that under circumstances of this nature, it's not necessary, because the only reason that the person does this is to prevent a situation of evil from arising, and therefore the husband will not be mevatel the get under those circumstances. The Rabbanut in Eretz Yisrael followed that pesach din, and by implication, it was accepted in America as well, because texts that were used during World War II provided for the execution of the get and did not provide for the re-execution of the get every time the husband came home. The Chazon Ish was opposed to that practice. He came up with some other device. The problem was that you have hundreds and literally thousands of soldiers, and they're coming home all the time. It's very hard for what they deem to execute a shlichus to every one of them. And the Chazon Ish came up with the idea of having the husband write a get himself and be the shliach himself. He would then write the get in his own handwriting, and then he would execute a shlichus for the execution of a proper get by a sefer and edim in Tzav Ashiri, and that wouldn't be done every time or whatever. It was a kind of it was an interesting kind of proposal, and one that I don't want to analyze in detail simply because it goes far beyond what we're talking about today. However, the problem with regard to a husband being meman a shliach for the execution of a get brings us directly to those problems. There is a presumption of bitul shlichus as soon as the parties cohabit. So that if the husband has been memani shliach for the execution of the get and the parties cohabit, there is a presumption that he's been mevatel the shlichus. I think that Avramsky's consideration is not germane in these circumstances, because under these circumstances, the husband is likely to be mevatel the shlichus, while he is not likely to be mevatel the shlichus in the wartime situation. In the wartime situation, the husband knows very well that when people go to war, some of them don't come back. Of course, it's always somebody else, not him. But he knows that the get, his whole hocus pocus, is being done on the very far-fetched chance that he will not return, and it's done only to prevent the wife from being an aduna, and he certainly doesn't want the wife to be an aduna. That's why he did it in the first place. Why in the world should he change the rules mid-game? However, when you're dealing with an aduna situation, or the Balam Sar of the Gari situation, the modern-day aduna situation, where the husband is doing all of this at the time of the chuppah, because somebody has pointed out to him that there are some people out there who get divorced and then refuse to execute a get, that the husband is doing this not because he realizes objectively that this is what should be done, because there may be some objective situation in which the wife becomes an aduna. He's really doing this against himself. When it's clear to the person that he's doing this against himself and against his own best interest, but only because it's been demanded of him as a kind of yesher or whatever, I doubt that Rav Avramsky's arguments would apply. Under those circumstances, the very first thing that the husband is going to do, if he can, is to be mevatel the shlichus. And he certainly can do that if there's a presumption that cohabitation is ipso facto a bitul of the shlichus. Under those circumstances, it would seem to me that Rav Avramsky would concede that there is bitul of the shlichus, or whatever, bitul of the get, if the parties have consorted. Moreover, it's very difficult to formulate a set of circumstances under which the shliach may act without involving us in problems of brera. Anything that involves a third party or a decision made by a third party is by definition brera. It would seem to me that if such a shlichus is predicated upon a decision of a secular court, which is again dependent upon the judgment of the judge, you have set up a situation of brera and would subject the whole business to defeat on those grounds. On the other hand, well, is the harshoah contingent or harshoah non-contingent? A standard harshoah, kisvus new type of harshoah, gives you absolute authority. You don't have to wait for a third party to decide that it's proper to execute a get. You're the shliach. You're aiming to become a bow. Just as I do it whenever I want to, you can do it whenever you want to. You can do it immediately. No one can force you to do it immediately, just as no one can force a shliach to be oisei shlichusa. It's a kind of a rough shliach oisei shlichusa. But we can't force a shliach. What is nitpasir on the shlichus? In the normal, I shouldn't use the word normal, but in order to overcome brera, you're going to have to say that you're going to set up a situation in which the shliach, whoever he may be, has absolute authority to execute the get whenever he wishes.
So
right. And under those circumstances, it seems to me that there's automatic veto of the shlichus every time there's cohabitation. That's the problem as I see it. Yes. Yes.
And then that
will
eliminate all these problems, and
then trust the shliach responsible for it. Yeah, yes. I think that was, clearly, if you're going to entrust it to responsible people who aren't going to proceed to execute a get simply because they have nothing to do this Monday or Thursday when they're sitting in the basement. But the problem then is that once you've done that, then it seems to me that there is an assumed beetle of the shlichus or beetle of the get, whichever is appropriate, whichever device you're using, whenever the parties cohabit, which would then render the whole thing nugatory. It won't help. It won't be of any good whatsoever. It won't help at all. Have I left out any of the other possible ways of dealing with the problem? And since I'm not going to talk about tradition of Pnai, we'll ignore that. So if you have no other further questions, I will consider this concluded.